Most adults remember where they were on the morning of Tuesday, September 11, 2001. In New York City, there were some thunderstorms the night before, but that day, 9/11, had started out beautiful and sunny with clear skies. Then people started noticing that some large passenger planes were flying too low.
911, operator 110.
Yes, I live in Staten Island. I'm sitting out front and this plane, I'm telling you, it's so low, it's the second time it came around. I really ain't expecting it to land in the water. I mean, it's that low. I live, I can see the bay on bridge from my front door. And there's a fighter jet escorting it. But the second time, I have to tell you, it looked pretty low. I mean, it's banking really steeply, so I don't know what's going on with it. But I'm not one to make phone calls like this, but I was wondering if there's something wrong with it.
3-1-1-2-1-2-3. I'm in Jersey City, New Jersey, and we want to know what's going on because there's like planes, look, they're going inside the buildings, everybody's outside going crazy.
There's what?
It looks like planes are going, they're like trying to go in the building, everybody's outside going crazy.
What's trying to go in the building?
It said like a plane was trying to go into one of the buildings.
A plane?
Yeah, but they don't know if it's like federal practices they do in the air, but we're all outside by the Hudson, and we don't know what's going on here. There's no cops, nobody's telling us anything.
When the first building was hit, there was confusion. Even the office workers who were in the building didn't know exactly what had happened, just that there was an explosion and lots of smoke.
Police operator 1886, where is your emergency?
Yeah, hi. I'm on the 106th floor of the World Trade Center. We just had an explosion on the 105th floor.
The 106th floor?
Yes.
106, okay.
We have a conference up there. There's about 100 people up here.
What is your last name?
Hanley, H-A-N-L-E-Y. We have smoke and it's pretty bad.
This is on the 106th floor, right?
Hello?
Okay, we have the job. Let me connect you with a fire, okay?
Yes, it's fire, smoke.
You have a,
we have...
Hold on, let me connect you with a fire, okay?
Here, we can't get down the stairs.
Hold on, let me connect you with fire.
Fire department, 408, where's the fire?
Yeah, hi. I'm on the 106th floor of the World Trade Center. We just had an explosion up here.
Okay, 106th floor. What building are you in, sir? One or two?
One World Trade.
All right.
One?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's smoke and we got about 100 people up here.
Sit tight. Do not leave, okay? There's a fire or an explosion or something in the building. All right, I want you to stay where you are.
Yes.
All right, what's your phone number there?
We're on the 106th floor.
Yeah, what's your phone number? Sir, your phone number. All right, we're there. We're coming up to get you.
I can see the smoke coming up from outside the windows down.
All right, we're on the way.
Huh?
We're on the way, sir.
Okay.
All right, just keep some windows open. If you can open up windows and just sit tight. It's going to be a while because there's a fire going on downstairs.
We can't open the windows unless we break.
Okay. Just sit tight. All right, just sit tight. We're on the way.
All right, please hurry.
The New York metropolitan area is home to the busiest airport system in the United States, with three major airports, JFK, Newark, and LaGuardia. On that morning, the air traffic controllers were also communicating about what they were seeing and trying to figure out what was happening.
Anybody know what that smoke is in Lower Manhattan?
I'm sorry, say again?
A lot of smoke in Lower Manhattan.
A lot of smoke in Lower Manhattan.
Out of the top of the World Trade Center building, a major fire.
Hey, can you look out your window right now?
Yeah.
Can you see a guy about 4,000 feet about 5 east of your airport right now? Looks like he's...
Yeah, I see him.
Did you see a guy? Look, is he descending for the building also?
He's descending really quick, too, yeah.
Well, that's...
2,500 feet now. He just dropped 800 feet in like one sweep.
That's another situation.
Another one just hit the building.
Wow. Oh my God. Another one just hit the
wall. The whole building just came apart.
Oh holy smokes.
On the ground, there were many 911 calls coming in. firefighters were deployed from stations all over the city, as well as police officers from the NYPD and the Port Authority. One of the people involved on that day is my guest for this episode, Tim Brown. He was a New York City firefighter for 20 years, and that knowledge and experience led to a job working in the mayor's office. He was specifically equipped to know what to do when any big emergency happened. He was one of the people who were in charge. But like everyone else that morning 20 years ago, he had no idea what he was about to experience. Real people in unreal situations.
There is a man standing in front of me in my bedroom.
My friend has been shot.
I'm literally inside the river, and I'm inside my car.
He had told me multiple times that he was going to set himself on fire.
If you say my name or try to look at me, I'm going to kill you.
And he was just sobbing. He said, Mom, Mom, tell me you're going to be okay.
And I jumped on the hood of the car, and I held on.
And I looked into the garage, and he was hanging from the rafters.
I had somebody standing on my neck.
He's better to me dead. I want him dead.
I'm Scott Johnson, and this is What Was That Like? Hey, it's Scott, and guess what? You're about to hear an ad. And that's both good and bad. It's good because ads are what make it possible for me to keep bringing you these episodes. And it's bad because, well, maybe you don't like listening to ads, and I get that. And the good news is, you don't have to. When you sign up to support the show, you get every single episode without any ads. Plus, you get all the bonus episodes. Yeah, did you know there are actually bonus episodes? And you can try it all for free just to see what it's like. If you're on an iPhone, just go to the What Was That Like podcast, and at the top, click on Try Free, and you're in. On Android, just go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus and try it out completely free. Once you've had the ad-free experience, you'll see why hundreds of other listeners are already doing it. But for now, here's another ad, and then on with today's episode.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of The Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to The Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
How many friends did you lose on 9/11?
Somewhere around 100 men I knew who I had worked with in my career. Some I was very close with. Some were more like acquaintances, but somewhere around 100 because I worked in the Special Operations Command of the New York City Fire Department. About one third of the firefighters murdered on September 11th were from our Special Operations Command. So about 100 firefighters were from Special Operations. The Special Operations Command took a very big hit. And then I knew a bunch of the NYPD police officers because out of their 23, 14 were from their elite Special Operations Emergency Service Unit. And I was on the FEMA Urban Search and Rescue Team with those heroes. We actually went to Oklahoma City together after the bombing there in 1995. So I spent five or six nights on the pile of that collapsed building, searching with these men. And then they were murdered also on September 11th in a subsequent terrorist attack.
What was your actual job in New York City at that time?
I was a firefighter for about 18 years, and I had become friends with Mayor Giuliani, and he had been asking me for a few years to go into his newly created Mayor's Office of Emergency Management. And I refused for a while because I was enjoying my job in Rescue 3 in the Bronx. But eventually in 1998, I did move out of a firehouse, and I, you know, kind of put on a tie and worked for the mayor and represented him at the scene of larger disasters and emergencies. So it was the Mayor's Office of Emergency Management where I was on September 11th.
And I know your office was in 7 World Trade.
Yeah.
Where was that in relation to the Twin Towers?
So 7 World Trade Center was directly across Vesey Street from the North Tower, which was 1 World Trade Center. And the way we used to try to remember that, because it's very confusing, is it's the building that has the towering antenna on it, kind of like a number 1. So we were directly across the street from 1 World Trade Center, which was the first of the towers to be struck by a passenger jet.
What were you doing when the first plane hit? And that was just before 9 a.m., correct?
Right, 8:46 a.m. Eastern time. I had gone into the office a little before 8 a.m., and I always went to the cafeteria on the 3rd floor, and I ate my breakfast there. I had my Cheerios and juice and some tea, and I read the newspapers. I would buy all the local newspapers and read them. This was before we had smartphones, so you know, you had to actually go buy the physical paper. And I would just blow through the papers just to ensure I was up to date on what was happening in the city. The power went out in our building, and for a modern high-rise building, that's fairly unusual. And 5 seconds later, the power kicked back in, and I knew we had lost our power source, our main feed, and that we were now on backup generator power, because that's how the building was designed. But I didn't hear or see anything immediately. But when the power went out, the people who were sitting at the glass facing the North Tower all at once jumped up and started running and screaming toward the exit. I didn't know why, and I grabbed this young lady by the shoulders, and I kind of had to shake her back to reality, and I said, what happened? And she said, a plane just hit the tower, and that was the first that I knew of it. Now, Scott, this was not a very unusual thing. I mean, it was unusual, but not unprecedented, I guess, because this had happened before, where a pilot has a heart attack, and his plane runs into one of the high-rises, or, you know, we had the bomber jet in World War II crash into the Empire State Building. So it was not completely unusual, but it was still a major emergency. You know, that's what we do, right? So, you know, time for action.
You knew immediately what your job priority was going to be that day, even though you didn't know what happened yet.
You're right. Game face on. You know, this is what we train for. This is what our experience is. I went up to the 23rd floor where our emergency operations center was located, including my office. I wanted to face-to-face with the supervisor of we called it Watch Command, which is our listening post, because we had to do a full activation of our emergency operations center, which means they needed to make about 150 phone calls to bring in all our partners from federal, state, local, and private sector to support this developing disaster that's happening across the street. Supervisor Mike Lee was there, and I kind of across the room, we caught each other's eyes, and I gave him the thumbs up, and he gave me a thumbs up back, like full activation. I ran over to the emergency operations center where Supervisor Mike Berkowitz was, and the same thing. I said, Mike, full activation. He gave me the thumbs up. He was already powering up the 150 workstations, all the screens, like kind of like a Star Wars command center, because very soon that was going to be filled with 150 people from different parts of the region who are going to be supporting the incident commander in the North Tower. I went to my desk and I grabbed my all three radios, portable radios, the OEM radio, the NYPD radio, and the FDNY fire radio. And I put the PD and the FD in my back pockets, so I had them with me, and I carried the OEM radio down to my car, which was parked on Vesey Street, right outside 7 World Trade Center, and right at the kind of base of the North Tower. I took off my tie and my dress shirt, and I put on our raid jacket, which says Mayor's Office on the front and back, and my heavy leather boots, and they made us wear this stupid green helmet so that we were identifiable as Mayor's Office guys. We're trained as firefighters to always look at three sides of a building that is being destroyed by fire or collapse or whatever it may be. And I wanted to do that before I went into the North Tower.
What's the purpose of looking at three sides from a firefighting standpoint?
It's to get a size up in your head the best you can, like the situational awareness. I was not the firefighter or the police officer. I could kind of take a step back a little bit. And I just wanted to get a better idea of what was happening from the outside, because once you go in, your vision is blocked off and your hearing, you know, you're just kind of in a cocoon when you're inside. And I just wanted to take probably a minute, not even a minute, to take a look. In order to do that, I had to run up from the street level to the plaza level. And there was an exterior one-story concrete staircase that I ran up. Later on, this becomes a famous staircase called the Survivor Staircase, because hundreds or thousands of office workers used this staircase to run away from the developing disaster and live. That staircase is in the 9/11 museum titled the Survivor Staircase. But I ran up this staircase as the firefighters and police officers did all day long. And I looked out over the plaza in between the World Trade Center complex, and it was littered with debris that was on fire, black smoke, fire, parts of the building, plane parts. And if you remember in the video, all the papers from the offices that are floating and fluttering down, that's exactly what it looked like. It looked like Armageddon. And at this point, I started to realize that this is maybe a little bit bigger than a small Cessna. I went into the North Tower at that level, at the plaza level, and I had to go down one level inside the building to get to the command station. And there was an escalator, and there were hundreds of office workers, like a funnel, trying to get on this escalator to go down and to go down again, to go underground and escape. That's the way that the security guys and gals and the police officers were directing them to evacuate. And I noticed in this moment, you know, what we always hear about is people pushing and screaming and climbing over each other and trampling each other in these types of situations, causing more injuries and death. But in this day, on this day, what I saw with my own eyes was the opposite. It was people helping each other. Regular office workers, not cops, not firemen. If someone was pregnant, obese, injured, or disabled, there were four or five regular office people helping that person. And I remember in my head thinking, no matter what happens today, we're going to be okay, because that's the true human spirit that I'm witnessing right now. When someone trips and falls next to us, we all reach down to help them up and give them a helping hand. That is 99.9% of humanity. And I was witnessing it in front of my eyes in this situation. Not understanding what was to come, I still carried that confidence with me through the rest of the day. I got into that crowd and I went down the escalator. And as the lobby revealed itself to me, I could see hundreds of firefighters in their turnout gear with the yellow reflective stripes on their gear. And there were hundreds of them awaiting their orders to go up. And I completely understood in this moment why the cops teasingly called us bumblebees. Because when we all get together by the hundreds like that, it looks like a hive. And that's exactly what I was looking at, a hive of firefighters awaiting their orders to go up. I got to the bottom of the escalator, and right in front of me was a bumblebee. Firefighter Chris Blackwell from Rescue 3, where I had worked in the Bronx with him for 7 years. Not only was Chris a Bronx Harlem fireman who, you know, we weren't really the reverent guys. We didn't really shave the way we were supposed to, and we didn't follow the rules we were supposed to. Our gear was all tattered and torn and burned up, and the helmet kind of sits a little off on your head because it's been in so many fires and it's all burned up. And that was Chris, the bumblebee in front of me. And not only did we work in the same firehouse together, but we worked on the same shift. So we were very, very close. We had been through tremendous, difficult situations before, and we'd always come through them relatively uninjured. And I loved this man like my brother. And we always greeted each other the same way. We came face to face, just a couple feet away from each other. And Chris always had the unlit stub of a cigar in his mouth, in the corner, right corner of his mouth. We came right up to each other. We came to attention. He reached up with his right hand and he took the stub of a cigar out of his mouth. And we leaned in and we kissed each other on the lips. And then we stood back at attention and he put the cigar back in his mouth. And of course, I love this man, and this is why I kissed him. But we just thought it was the funniest thing that it grossed all the other firemen out. And so that's why we did it.
I think it's hilarious, too. You know, you're talking about the cigar in his mouth and a firefighter, a tough guy. It's all stereotypical, yeah. New Yorker up until the kiss.
it's wonderful. It's just, and we did this in the most horrific of situations. Just to kind of bring people back to reality, you know? And we did this on the morning of September 11th. He was the first bumblebee I ran into. And relating this story to his family later on gave them such relief and warmth that Chris knew how much he was loved. After Chris and I greeted each other, he said to me, "Timmy, this is really bad." And I said, "I know, Chris. Be careful. I love you." And he said, "I love you too." And he turned around and he went in the stairwell and he went up. And that's a really important part of the story because he said those words to me, "Timmy, this is really bad." And for us to say that to each other after all these years in the Special Operations Command of the Bronx Harlem Fire Department, those words mean something. He knew it, Scott. He knew it. But you know what he did? He turned around and he went in the stairwell and he fulfilled his oath. His oath was to help people he didn't know at the risk of his own life. And he knew that there was a pretty good chance that when he went in that stairwell, he would not come back down. But he still did it. Someone yelled my name across the bumblebees, across the lobby. And I looked over and I could see my best friend, Captain Terry Hatton, Captain of Rescue 1, the Manhattan Special Operations Elite. He was my best friend. And he was put in that position because he was that good. He was the boss of Rescue 1. He was the future of the New York City Fire Department. And the big chiefs were grooming him so that one day he could be one of the big chiefs and run the New York City Fire Department. That's how much Terry Hatton was respected. He had the experience and the knowledge hard to find in one person. And he was always thinking 6-7 steps ahead of everyone else. I ran over to my best friend. He was easy to spot because he was 6'4". With his helmet and boots on, he was 6'7", 6'8". And I ran to him, and he opened his arms up wide, and I ran into his chest, and I wrapped my arms around him, and he leaned down, and he wrapped his arms around me, and he squeezed me tight, and he kissed me on my right cheek, and he said in my ear, "I love you, brother. I may never see you again." And I blew him off because we had done so many very, very dangerous things together, things that no one should ever come back from, because I trusted him and I followed him wherever we went. And we always did it and we always came back. But Terry was a smart one, and he knew it, and he said it to me, "I love you, brother. I may never see you again." And he kissed me on the cheek. After saying that to me, he turned around and he went in the stairwell with his men, the men of Rescue 1, and he went up. The men of Rescue 1 made it to the 83rd floor of the North Tower, where they were fighting the fire and saving the lives of people who were burned and broken. When there was an interior collapse, not the big collapse, but an early interior collapse, and they got trapped. And I did not witness this myself. This was told to me later on by firefighters who did witness that my best friend, Captain Terry Hatton, was screaming into the radio the worst thing a fireman could ever say or hear. "Mayday, mayday, mayday. Rescue 1 is trapped. Mayday, mayday, mayday. Rescue 1 is trapped. 83rd floor." The elite Manhattan firefighters, whose primary job was to save other trapped firefighters, were now trapped themselves. That's how bad this was. One of his men made it down to the lobby, minus his helmet. His head was full of blood, and he was begging for other firefighters to go back up and help him to get his brothers out of being trapped. I did not witness any of this because I would have been in that stairwell going up. A firefighter came into the lobby where we were screaming, "Another plane just hit the South Tower." And that's the first I knew of it.
Here's my hot take for today. If you see something advertised as a free trial, it might cost you more than you expect. At least that's my experience. I give up my credit card to try something for free for a week, then I forget about it, and now I'm paying for it every month without even noticing it. But when I signed up for Rocket Money, that ridiculous waste came to a screeching halt. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending, and it helps you lower your bills so you can grow your savings. It lets you see all of your subscriptions listed right there in one place. When you see a subscription you're paying for but you don't want, do you really want to spend an hour on the phone trying to track down some customer service agent to cancel it? Rocket Money can help you get rid of it with just a few taps. They also give me this great dashboard so I can see what I've spent this month compared to last month. And they'll even try to negotiate lower bills for me by up to 20%. So I'm spending less and saving more. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features.
Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/whatwas. That's rocketmoney.com/whatwas. rocketmoney.com/whatwas.
This episode is sponsored by Cook Unity. Go to cookunity.com/what or enter code WHAT before checkout for 50% off your first week. When Jeannie and I go out to eat at some local restaurant, one of the things I love to try is a curry dish. I just love it when a chef can get that perfect balance of spices. It's one of my favorite meals. But even better is to have an amazing curry meal without having to go out, like the one I had recently. It was cauliflower and chickpea coconut curry with steamed jasmine rice. And even though it was created by a professional local chef here in Florida, we enjoyed that meal right here at home, thanks to Cook Unity. And you know what else I love? All the prep and cooking is done for me ahead of time. So all I do is just choose the one I want, and 2 minutes later, I'm enjoying a tasty hot meal. It feels like I'm one of those wealthy podcasters with a chef on staff right here at home. Cook Unity meals arrive fresh, they've never been frozen, all of their packaging is earth-friendly, and it's cheaper than other delivery options. Oh, and you have to try that coconut curry.
Experience chef-quality meals every week delivered right to your door. Go to cookunity.com/what or enter code WHAT before checkout for 50% off your first week. That's 50% off your first week by using code WHAT or going to cookunity.com/what.
I'll confess, sometimes I let my podcast playlist get out of hand and I get way behind. But there's one show that I subscribe to and any new episode goes right to the top of the queue. That's the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's because I never have to figure out, okay, is this one going to be interesting or do I wait for the next one like I do for some shows? Because Jordan's conversations are always a must-listen for me. He talks to fascinating people from any category you can think of. Authors, scientists, athletes, you name it. He's talked to undercover cops who posed as mafia and the actual career mafia hitmen. And the stories he gets out of these people, just incredible. In one episode, he talked to Paul Holes. You might know that name if you're into true crime. He's the former investigator who uses really advanced methods to solve cold cases, including the Golden State Killer. And another one I really enjoyed was with Sam Harris, an author and neuroscientist who promotes skepticism, and he doesn't mind taking on some seriously controversial topics like politics or religion. That one's going to make you think. Whenever a new episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show pops up, I already know it's going to be an episode that I'll enjoy listening to, and I'll bet you will too. For some episode recommendations, check out jordanharbinger.com/start. Or search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The leadership huddled up, and it was decided that myself and Assistant Chief Donald Burns would go to the South Tower to open that command post and take command of the second greatest disaster in the history of the city of New York, occurring at the same time, right next door to the first greatest disaster to hit the city of New York. Chief Burns, 41 years in the New York City Fire Department, possibly the most respected chief in the New York City Fire Department at that time. Another big guy, 6'4". And if you saw in the or you looked up in the dictionary, Irish fire chief, it would be his mug, because he had the red rosy cheeks, the permanent lines of experience in his face from his long nights standing outside in minus 10 degree snow and ice fighting fires. Every line in his face he earned. And Chief Burns grew up in the outer boroughs, so he had a little bit of a thicker New York accent. And he only talked out of the right side of his mouth. And he talked fast. And I said, "Chief, what do you need me to do?" As we ran from the North Tower to the South Tower. He said, "Timmy, there's not much you and I can do. I've ordered a fifth alarm," another 350 firefighters. "But the first fifth alarm is going to the other building. We got to wait. Do your best and be careful." And I saluted Chief Burns, my friend. And I said, "Yes, sir." A woman came over to us screaming, that there were people trapped in an elevator. Chief Burns gave me the nod, go with her. Chief Burns went to the command post. I followed this lady, and she took me right to the elevator banks of the South Tower. She took me to one elevator specifically, and the hoistway doors to the elevator were open, and you could see into the shaft. But the elevator car was stuck at the top, and you, just like 1 foot, you could see into the elevator car. You could see all the people's feet who were trapped, and they were screaming. And I could see the men's suit jacket and dress shirt as their hands and wrists were trying to pull the elevator down another foot or two so they could get out. And they were screaming. I did not know at the time that they had just taken a 70-story free fall, because when Flight 175 slammed into the South Tower, it snapped the cable and their elevator free fell 70 floors. But the emergency brakes on the elevator worked as they were supposed to and stopped it before it hit the concrete pit and saved their lives. But now those elevator brakes were locked on and they were not letting go. And there was no way that human strength was going to move that elevator car. In addition to all of this, the elevator pit below them was full of jet fuel that was on fire, and they were getting burned. And what they needed was a firefighter, not a mayor's office guy. In my kind of panic, I guess, at seeing this, I mean, this all took 5 seconds, right? I turned to my right to see if I could just see something or someone to help. And my shoulder hit a person, and I looked over, and it was a bumblebee. And I looked up at his face, and it was firefighter Mike Lynch from Ladder 4, a young firefighter who I had helped train in the 90s, early 90s. He was my friend, and he was a real good firefighter. And in fact, he was so well-respected that Captain Terry Hatton was recruiting him to go to the Elite Special Operations Rescue 1. So we had great confidence and faith in firefighter Michael Lynch from Ladder 4. And he put his hand on my shoulder, my right shoulder, and he squeezed it a little bit, and he said, Timmy, I got it. 3 words, I got it. Between firefighters who knew each other and trained together and had experience together, 3 words that meant he had the training, the experience, the tools and equipment, because he was wearing his turnout gear. He had his hand tools, and he brought a whole fire truck, Ladder 4, full of tools with him, a rolling toolbox. He's what those people needed. Timmy, I got it. Over my OEM radio, an urgent message. Urgent, urgent, urgent. Third plane incoming. Confirmed by the FBI. It's ours. Impact imminent. Get in the stairwell. Take cover. Urgent, urgent, urgent. If planes keep crashing into us, we can't do our job and save people. I said to firefighter Mike Lynch, my friend Mike, I got to go. You got this. I ran to the command post. I picked up a landline that I found that worked, and I dialed 0 for operator, and she picked up right away. And I said, I'm with Mayor Giuliani in the World Trade Center. I need to talk to the White House immediately. She tried to get through to the White House. She couldn't get through. I said, then I need to talk to the Pentagon. And she said, the Pentagon's under attack. And that's the first we knew of it. Our situational awareness was about 0. I talked to New York State Emergency Management Office, and they promised me that the fighter jets had already been scrambled and were coming to us as fast as they could to protect us overhead. And that's what I wanted. It was the first time in the history of the New York City Police Department, New York City Fire Department, Port Authority Police Department, an army of 50,000 or more, that we needed help from United States military. The lobby was filling up with people who were injured, and they were laying all over the lobby, and it was impeding our evacuation progress. Imagine if you're an injured person and you were on the 78th floor, you're burned or you're broken or bloody, and your only way out is to go down 70, 80 floors around and around and around and around and around in a dark, smoky, wet stairwell. And then you get to a door that says lobby on it, and you push the door open, and it's light and dry, and you see cops and firemen, and you think, I made it. I'm safe. They're going to take care of me. And so these people, when they made it to the lobby, they had nothing left, and they collapsed all over the lobby. So Chief Burns ordered me to go find the paramedics and bring the paramedics in, because all the firefighters and police officers were going up. So that's why I left the South Tower. I went out on Liberty Street, and the first thing I saw burned into my visual memory forever, out of my left eye, was a dead firefighter in the street who had been crushed by a woman who fell or jumped from the upper floors and instantly killed him. It had just happened seconds before I went out, and his buddies were yanking at what was now two bodies that became one, trying to pull them out of danger, thinking they could save him, but it was too late. I heard someone yell my name, and I looked over, and it was firefighter Mike Lynch, who was at his truck, ladder 4, and he was getting what we call the jaws of life off. It's the spreaders we use in a car accident. Very powerful, and they're run by a hydraulic motor, and that motor is really heavy. So Michael was yelling to me to go help him take that motor off the truck. And so I started running toward him, but another firefighter got there first, and Mike waved to me, and I waved back to Mike, and it would be the last time I saw my friend. I broke off, and I ran to the paramedics. I found the paramedics, Captain Charlie Wells, my friend, and I said, we have to move triage into the north lobby. And he said, okay, and they got their stuff together. We put on our helmets, or they put on their helmets, and we loaded the stretcher up with all their, I call it doctor equipment. And myself and three paramedics with the stretcher went running from West Street back up to Liberty Street, heading back into the South Tower lobby. We were running on the sidewalk right along and very close to the Marriott Hotel, which was 3 World Trade Center, which adjoined the South Tower, 2 World Trade Center. As we rounded the corner, because the South Tower was set back on the sidewalk a bit, we were about 20 feet from the door of the South Tower when it collapsed. We were still outside, so we could hear it. The first indication was a very loud crack, like lightning struck right next to you. It was so loud that it reverberated through the canyons of Lower Manhattan. But we knew, I mean, it was so loud, we knew what it was. Without saying anything, anybody that heard that knew what it was.
Did you ever expect one of the towers to actually collapse?
No. Our fire department expert on collapse, Chief of Special Operations Ray Downey, had the conversation with the mayor in the north lobby early on, and his expert opinion, based on fact and experience, was that the fire would burn up and it would burn itself out. There was no way we could get enough water up there to physically put the fire out, but it would just burn up the rest of the building, and then eventually it would go out when it had no more fuel. And that's truly what Chief Downey believed at that time, and that's what any collapse expert in America would say. So it was completely unexpected, But for whatever reason, I guess it was so loud that we knew. And we're trained as firefighters. You can never outrun a collapse. You have to seek immediate cover. So I yelled to the paramedics, follow me into the Three World Trade Center, which was the Marriott Hotel, which was adjoining. We had just run by the doors into the Marriott, and I knew we had just run by them. And I knew that we had to get into that building to protect us from the collapsing tower. So we ran in those doors, and it was as clear as the room all of us are sitting in right now. And with the snap of your fingers, it went pitch black, and I hit the ground. We were in the restaurant called the Tall Ships Restaurant, which was the restaurant in the lobby of the Marriott Hotel. Everything that wasn't nailed down was blowing in our faces because two World Trade Center was collapsing on Three World Trade Center, and Three World Trade Center was now collapsing around us. You couldn't see because of the dust. You couldn't breathe because of the dust. The dust was so thick, it was filling up your nose and ears and mouth and eyes. And I was trying to stick my mouth in my shirt to try and filter some of the dust. I'm on all fours, and I'm crawling away from where the collapse is coming at us as fast as I can. And I know from my experience that if I can find a vertical column, it's the only chance I have at living. Because I know from experience in collapses that we find people alive next to vertical columns, which are the strongest part of any building. And so I'm crawling as fast as I can, desperate to survive, and I found a vertical column, and I wrapped my arms around this huge column, and I squeezed with all my might, and this wind is lifting my legs off the ground. It blew the helmet off my head, and I'm trying with all my strength to hold on to this column because I know it's the only shot I have at living. And I just waited to be crushed. And my thought in that moment was that I wasn't ready to die. I'm not afraid of dying. I just wasn't ready to die. And I wanted to hold my brother one more time and my family one more time and tell them I love them. And I just waited to be crushed. And as fast as it started, Scott, it stopped. And it was less than 30 seconds, the whole thing. And I was alive. I crawled desperately to try to get back to Liberty Street where I had come in. But of course, the landscape was completely different now because the building collapsed. You know, you still couldn't see, you still couldn't breathe. I came to a truck, and the engine was running. It was a diesel, I could tell, and the headlights were on. You would think I would recognize it if it was a fire truck. I did not recognize it as a fire truck. And for whatever reason, in my panic and desperation to get out, all I could think of was that it was a truck bomb. And so I turned around and I went deeper into the restaurant, deeper into the hotel, trying to get away from what I perceived was a truck bomb, which it turned out not to be. And I came to a metal roll-down gate that was meant to separate the restaurant from the hotel lobby when the restaurant was closed. And in the collapse, this metal roll-down gate had come down. But I was pretty determined to go through it. And so I reached my fingers under it and lifted it up. And it lifted up. And when I did, all these fingers came from the other side, from people who were trapped on the other side of it. And together we lifted this roll down gate up. And I said, we have to go that way. There was about 15 people, firefighters and civilians who they were rescuing. And they said, there is no that way. It's gone. The collapse had come in right behind them in the lobby of the Marriott Hotel. It had killed half the people they were with and taken them and their bodies in the floors down 7 stories. So right behind them was a 7-story drop. And they were on this ledge between this 7-story drop and the metal roll-down gate. So when we opened the gate up, when we pulled the gate up, it was their salvation. And now my salvation. And we went, turned around again and went back into the what was left of the restaurant. And we crawled across the steel in the rubble. And one of the ladies in the line we had formed saw a really bright flashlight on the outside. And she could hear the firefighter yelling, come to me. And so we like formed a chain and we all followed and made our way out to this firefighter. And that's the story of my survival. There were about 35 people in that area of the Marriott Hotel who survived, which was very unusual. There were really only 2 pockets of people in the 18-acre complex who survived. They did a scientific study of that space where we were, and it was determined scientifically that wind that tried to blow me out into the street that lifted my legs up off the ground was 185 miles per hour. And so I have no idea how I was able to hold on to that steel column other than to say that God did not want me at this point in my life. There are too many steps there that kept me alive for me to think anything other than he, with a capital H, was not ready to welcome me into his kingdom just yet. And over the last 20 years, I think this is exactly why. Because he wanted me to tell the story of the heroes. The 343 firefighter heroes, the 37 Port Authority police heroes, the 23 NYPD police heroes, who all fulfilled the oath they had taken when they became firefighters or police officers, that they would give their life if it meant saving the life of someone they didn't know. And that's what these firefighters and police officers did, right? They all did what Captain Terry Hatton and firefighter Chris Blackwell and Captain Patty Brown did. They went in that stairwell and went up knowing that they probably would not come back. And I will, as long as I have a voice, Scott, I will always speak of them. I will speak their names. I will speak of their heroism. I will speak of the families they left behind and the children that missed them as they grew up.
After this all happened, you went to visit the widow of firefighter Mike Lynch, who went to save these people in the elevator. How long after that did it happen? How long after 9/11 did you visit with her, and what happened there?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it was a matter of days. I mean, we were reeling, right? I mean, there's no other way to say it. It was us trying to manage chaos, but the chaos was so big that all we could do was manage our little piece of it. And like, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. And that's where we were at. We were so overwhelmed. But one thing caught my attention. There had been a rumor swirling around that Ladder 4 was not saving people's lives. Instead, they were looting the stores, if you can believe someone actually published this. And Ladder 4 was where firefighter Michael Lynch was assigned. And so when I heard that rumor, and that it was getting into the media, I panicked a little bit and I said, Michael's widow, Denise, has to hear from me what her husband and Ladder 4 was doing on the day of September 11th, because I was with them I witnessed it, and she has to know that this rumor is a lie. So I got in my new, because all our cars were destroyed, but I had a new like undercover police car thing. And I ran and I jumped at it and I went lights and sirens out to Long Island to Michael's widow Denise's home.
Hey, this is Scott. Did you know we offer a premium feed of this show that is completely ad-free and there are bonus episodes? Go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus or just click the link in the show notes of any episode to learn more and to sign up. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, you can sign up right there in the app by clicking Try Free at the top of the episode list. And I hope to see you in the premium feed soon.
And I went into her living room and sat on the couch with her. And I described the heroics of her husband in his last moments. In the way I described him in the lobby of the South Tower at that elevator where those poor people were trapped, when he said to me, "Timmy, I got it," he may as well have had angel's wings coming out of his back, because he was the angel sent by God to save the lives of those people. He just appeared out of nowhere at my side. When I said in my head, "What these people need is a real firefighter, not a mayor's office guy," he just like appeared like an angel out of nowhere. And I told Denise this story and that he was working on saving those lives. Later on, we find out that he saved three women from that elevator before the South Tower collapse. So we know his last act of heroism as the angel firefighter Michael Lynch was fulfilling his oath, saving the lives of people he didn't know. Unfortunately, he couldn't get them all out, but we know he got three out. When I was saying goodbye to Denise and her two little boys who were under 2 years old, who were running around the living room, you know, they're two, they don't know what's going on. I gave her my contact info. And I said, "One day when your sons are older and they want to know about their hero dad, please ask them to find me. I'd be happy to talk to them." Well, about a year ago, I got an email from Michael Francis Lynch Jr., 22 years old, asking me if I would tell him about his dad. And I said, "Yeah, let's meet down at my favorite place down at the World Trade Center now called O'Hara's Pub. We'll walk over to your dad's name on the memorial and we'll talk about your dad." And just like his dad, 6'4", handsome as could be, with a steel soul, confident as ever, and 22-year-old, that his demeanor and appearance was like he was a 40-year-old man. And I told him about his dad and his dad's heroism in the last minute. And young Michael had not had a good experience with father figures growing up. He was kind of the man of his house. Men came and went in his life. So I promised him in this moment that I was his forever, and that I would mentor him and help him and be his friend until my last breath. And so that's how it's been. He's an incredible young man. His dad would be extremely proud. And again, maybe this is why, you know, God spared me that day too. I asked Michael, he already earned his bachelor's degree. This is how good this young man is. But now he wanted to go into the military and be an Army Ranger. And I said, that's awesome, man. That's a great goal. And I understand your passion that you don't want other young kids like you to have to grow up the way you grew up because we were attacked on American soil. I said, but don't sign anything, please. Not right away. Come meet some of my friends, because I had made a lot of friends over the last 20 years in the military and in the intelligence community. I said, I have some very cool friends. And so for about a year, a little less than a year, 8 months probably, we kind of took a tour of the East Coast military facilities together. Every person I introduced to Michael took him under their wing and gave them their cell phone number and their email and said, I want to help you. Michael now has this whole community from people in the FBI and the CIA and other intelligence agencies and the special forces and the Rangers and the SEALs. He has some very cool friends. He has their phone numbers that he can reach out to if he has questions. And after all of this, and after his kind of, I guess, his master's in education, I said, so what do you want to do now? And he said, well, I want to be a SEAL. And I said, that's kind of where I thought you would wind up. So he is working very hard with some former SEALs right now, because it's, especially now, it's going to be very, very difficult for him to get through it, to earn his Trident. For many reasons, let's just say. So I will be there with him through thick and thin. We all will be. And I feel like he has been one of the greatest gifts I've had in my life. And I'm so proud of him. His dad would be so proud of him. And I love that our community has adopted him, as we have with many of the young people. The young people, without me knowing, I found out later on, but they gave me the nickname the Shepherd. You know, if they need help, any of these young people, they know they can call me, and I can give them the best of advice that maybe their dad would have given them.
As proud as you are of Mike Jr., I'm sure his dad would be just as grateful to you for stepping in and taking that role and giving him some direction. Your empathy and compassion is just breathtaking.
Yeah, thank you. That's my mom. That's my mom. Yeah, she left us last year, you know, but she did instill that in all five of her children. And that's, you learn that stuff when you're a kid, and I thank her forever for that. And I'm happy I can give it back. Most people, going back to the escalator scene, when people were helping each other, that is human empathy and compassion. And I think we all have it in us. It takes some extreme conditions sometimes for it to come out, but we all have that in us. I think it's beautiful.
We're at the 20th anniversary now of 9/11. Are there any events going on to commemorate or to honor that, the people that lost their lives on that day?
Yes, there are many events going on throughout the country. This specifically in New York, the 9/11 Memorial and Museum will be, as they do every year except last year, they'll be reading the names of the 2,977 plus the others killed in 1993 bombing. They'll be reading those names on the plaza. That is a family's only event. The museum will be open again to the families only on the day of September 11th. But around the day of September 11th, the memorial and museum will be open to the public. The memorial and museum will also be doing the two towers of light, I believe on the night of the 10th and the night of the 11th, which if you have not seen that, it's pretty spectacular. And then the Steven Siller Tunnel to Towers Foundation is doing numerous events, the biggest of which right now is that the CEO, Frank Siller, whose brother, Steven Siller, was a hero New York City fireman murdered on September 11th. Frank is walking from the Pentagon to Shanksville, Pennsylvania, to the World Trade Center in New York. It's about 537 miles he's walking. He is 68 years old. He had a heart attack last year. He's in the best shape of anyone that age maybe I've ever met. He's going to make the whole 537 miles. There are events along the way. Every Saturday, they do a remembrance parade in different parts of the East Coast. And when he gets to Staten Island, which is where his family is from, we will be having a welcoming remembrance parade for Frank on, I think it's the 9th. And then on the morning of the 11th, a few of us will walk with him from Staten Island over the Verrazano Bridge into Brooklyn to Squad 1, FDNY Squad 1, which is where Steven Siller worked. And we'll have a remembrance ceremony there at Steven's firehouse. And then we'll walk, retracing Steven's footsteps, to the mouth of the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel. The tunnel that Steven ran through with 60 pounds of gear on the morning of September 11th. And Steven's family will retrace his steps through the tunnel to the other side, where we will meet them to the World Trade Center. And then we'll have a remembrance there. So that's kind of like the big event. It's to raise awareness of the Tunnel to Towers Foundation, which is my number one charity. And then the other big event that has not been done before that the Siller Foundation is spearheading is on the 12th, September 12th, we will be at Ground Zero reading the thousands of names of the first responders who died from 9/11 illness subsequent to 9/11. So that's never been done before. We're going to do that on the 12th. And then later on in November, we're going to read the names at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. We're going to read the names of the 7,000-plus volunteer military heroes who lost their lives in the global war on terror. That's also never been done before, but we're going to start that tradition now. And every year, we will read the names of those heroes who volunteered for the U.S. military for us, for our community. A lot of them were wearing patches sewn onto their uniforms of the NYPD or the Port Authority Police or the New York City Fire Department when they took their last breath. They did that for America, but specifically, they served justice for our community. And starting this year, we will never forget, and we will say every one of their names at the Lincoln Memorial, and we will say thank you to their families.
I love that. Those are names that should never be forgotten.
Yes.
One last question. You've told this story many times. I know you've done TED Talks. Why do you feel it's important for people to know this?
Shortly after 9/11, probably in the days after 9/11, what started appearing in every firehouse and on every firefighter's bumper sticker was the mantra, never forget. And if we don't speak, if I don't have a voice and speak their names loudly, we will forget. I made that promise to them back then, the police officers, the firefighters, and now the military. Because for us, Scott, September 11th is every day. For example, young Michael Lynch, he grew up without his dad. His brother Jack grew up without his dad. Their mom grew up without the father of her children. She had to do it all on her own. And this is true for all the families. The nearly 3,000 murdered on September 11th. It's true for all of them. For the 7,300 plus military heroes, the thousands who died from 9/11 illness, all those families live 9/11 every day. And we have to remind America and the world of their heroism and their sacrifice so that we can live in freedom. If we don't remind America and the world, then we have failed and they have lost their lives for nothing.
Tim Brown, thank you for your service. Thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you for having me and sharing the story.
If you want to check out the charity that Tim mentioned, it's called the Tunnel to Towers Foundation, and the website is t2t.org. That's the letter T, the number 2, and the letter T again, .org. And if you'd like to contact Tim directly, his email address is in the show notes for this episode at whatwasthatlike.com/88. And by way of announcement, if you're in the Facebook group, you've probably heard discussion about an upcoming special bonus episode about childbirth. This is where we hear from a bunch of different women about their childbirth experience, what went right and what went wrong. Well, the announcement is that this bonus episode now has a date. It'll be published on Friday, October 15, 2021. That's in between the regular episodes. So if you're already subscribed to What Was That Like, that bonus episode will show up automatically wherever you listen to podcasts. Another good reason to subscribe, because that way you never miss a show. Now, there's something I want to mention here before we get to this week's listener story, and it's this. I never want what you hear on this podcast to be boring or predictable. And I see those as two different things. For the never be boring part, I try to take care of that in advance by being very picky about the stories I talk about on the podcast. Believe me, for every story you actually hear, there are like 50 that I had to reject. And there are lots of reasons for that, but that's just how it is. The way I look at it, one of my jobs as the host here is to protect you, my listener, from being bored. And just between you and me, out of all my listeners, you're my favorite. But the other thing is, I don't want it to be predictable. You know how when you're watching an action movie and the hero character gets captured by the bad guy and it looks like there's no way out for him? Well, even though it looks like it's the end of the road for the hero, you know in the back of your mind, and having watched 100 movies like this before, that there's no way the main character is actually going to be killed. You just know something's going to happen. Someone you thought was already dead turns out to be alive and saves his or her life, or the bad guy slips and falls into the alligator pond, or something. But the end result is that the good guy wins and everyone's happy, including the production company, because that means they make more money when they make the crappy sequel. Well, that's not how it always goes here on this podcast. Really, the only thing you can predict accurately is that the guest for the episode made it out alive, obviously, since I'm talking to that person. But other than that, things might turn out good, or they might turn out not so good. What we're talking about here is real life, true stories. And real life doesn't always have a happy ending. But I'd rather talk about reality than have a Hollywood scripted ending. I hope that's the way you like it too. If you have any comments about that, agree or disagree, please come over to the Facebook group and let's talk about it. whatwasthatlike.com/Facebook. And now, this week's listener story. Stay safe. I'll see you here in 2 weeks.
Hello, everyone. My name is Natalia. I'm Brazilian, and I work as an English teacher here in Brazil. The story I'm going to tell you happened a couple of years ago when I was starting out in a new job, an English course. And during one of my classes, I had a very bad bellyache. So in the short break between two classes, I ran to the bathroom to relieve myself. And the bathroom was connected to the teacher's room, where all of my colleagues were gathered, waiting for the next class to start. So I was really embarrassed of opening the door and let everybody smell the reminiscent odor of my diarrhea. So I had the idea of opening the bathroom's window to let the wind circulate a little before opening the door. But the window was stuck. It was like glass made and it was stuck. And as I tried to force it, it fell. It fell and it broke into a million pieces on the ground. And everybody heard the noise. And they knocked on the door, asked if I was all right. So I had to open it. And, well, they not only could smell it, but they could also see that I was trying to get rid of the smell by breaking the window. So it was really, really humiliating. But I didn't get fired